You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 165. Here's the thing about power. What good is power if you got nobody to share it with? Shazam.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro-budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Now, guys, so many filmmakers out there go the route of making a short film in hopes of it being seen by somebody in Mount Hollywood, where they will come down and go, "We want to make your short film into a feature film." And then that will launch your career into doing huge, big-budget horror movies or big-budget studio superhero films, and your life would be set as a filmmaker. And that is the dream of so many filmmakers out there. But alas, it happens once in a blue moon, and today's guest did exactly what I just said. We have today writer-director David F. Sandberg. Now, David made a short film, or actually made a bunch of short films, back in 2013. He was just making it with his girlfriend, now wife, in their house. Very simple, very low budget, not too complex, but they were scary as all hell. And one of those shorts happens to be called Lights Out. And that short went around the festival circuit, but didn't make a whole lot of noise for some reason. You know, he got here, got there, got a couple of awards, but definitely did not set the festival circuit on fire. So then he posted it up online through YouTube, and all of a sudden, it went viral. People were watching it. It was going up tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, up to millions of times being seen. And one of those people that saw it was director James Wan, the filmmaker behind The Conjuring Universe, Saw, Furious 7, and Aquaman, just to name a few. Now, James helped him produce the feature version of Lights Out, which went on to make $150 million at the box office with a $5 million budget. His next film was Annabelle Creation, which also did obscene amounts of money. With a $15 million budget, it grossed over $300 million worldwide. And soon after that, he was offered Shazam, being part of the DC Universe. And arguably, Shazam is one of the most fun, enjoyable films in the DC Universe. And it was it's a rag-to-riches story. He came from across the world, couldn't afford an apartment here while the first movie was getting done. There were so many amazing stories that he gave us in this episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with David F. Sandberg.
I'd like to welcome to the show David Sandberg. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
As good as I can be in this insane world that we live in, but I'm yeah. doing well, man. I'm better than I should. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, but pretty much same here. Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much for being on the show, man. I'm a fan of your work, and I wanted to kind of talk shop with you for a little bit. So first things first, why did you decide to be a filmmaker? What made you want to come into this ridiculous business?
I mean, I've always been fascinated by movies and always wanted to make movies. Like, since I was very young, like, I think my dad bought a video camera when I was, well, I think I was 5, actually. So it's always been a thing, and I've always been sort of fascinated about how it works and how to do it. And, one of my early sort of memories, I remember, because I was playing around with my dad's video camera and like, okay, this is how it works. And then I remember watching The Muppets as a kid, and they had this thing where they a musical number, and when they were changing angles, I was like, how do they do that? Because I only knew like having one camera. So it's like, do they everyone just pause at a certain moment and then they move it around and then they do it again? Like, I was trying to figure out like how does that work? Multi-camera thing. It's always been my goal and it's always been what I've wanted to do. I've had certain other interests, but movies have always been the thing.
And well, let's give a shout out to the Muppet Show for artists. We're similar vintages. I'm a little older than you, but we're similar vintages. The Muppet Show.
Yeah.
was the thing, man, growing up. And by the way, everyone listening, all 5 seasons will be on Disney Plus coming next month. So
yeah, I saw that.
that should be fun. Now, you also did a lot of animated shorts. What drew you, no pun intended, to animation when you first started out?
It was actually necessity. Like, I've always liked drawing and, you know, like comic books and stuff like that. And then as I was in my early 20s or something like that, I really started messing around with it because it was something I could do all by myself. And my first real animated short was something I made after I was going to do a horror movie with some friends in Sweden. This was during the winter and it was so cold that we gave up after just shooting a couple of shots. And then when I got back home, it's like, all right, I still want to do something. So I made like a little animated. I mean, it was actually barely even animated. It was almost like a slideshow. But I made that, and this was in early 2006, and I put it up on YouTube because I'd just gotten an account there because I was like, I didn't even know what it was. It's like, okay, you can upload videos. So I uploaded that, and it actually got some traction in Sweden, you know, got some views, and people seemed to really like it. So I made another short that got even more attention that went viral in Scandinavia, which got me like, won some awards at like a film festival and started getting companies asking me to do like, hey, could you do a little animated short for our company that we can put up on YouTube or so I was starting to get, you know, work doing that. Not a lot of money or anything, but I was able to like start my own company, which was just me, but so I could charge people for it. So I did that and did documentary work for a few years in Sweden, and made an okay living out. Like sometimes I had money, so other times I had to live off my wife, and because she had a steady job, you know.
I know that feeling very well.
Yeah,
we're filmmakers. Isn't it true that filmmakers in general should have a spouse that is extremely supportive and also does not work in the business or has a steady job outside the business?
It certainly helps. Yeah, but the goal for us, for Lotta and me, my wife, was mm-hmm. to make things together. And that's what we started doing. We started making shorts together, and that's how we made Lights Out, which went even more viral than anything I'd done before, and which led to ending up here in Hollywood.
So you'd make, so you've been, and from my saw in your filmography, you were making shorts constantly. You're making these small shorts and just kind of putting them out, and then you made Lights Out, and you just posted it, not really thinking much. It was just another short. It wasn't like, this is the thing that's going to blow me up or anything like that.
No. It was actually just the second short that Lotta and I made together.
Oh, wow.
Because what happened was, you know, I'd started doing like animated shorts and things like that, and got a little bit of a following on YouTube from Swedes, because it was mostly in Swedish. Uh-huh. And then, we did a little short called Camp Closer, Lotta and I, which was just 2 minutes, something like that. But we really enjoyed that. And we were like, let's keep doing this. And we saw a contest online, like make an under 3 minute horror short and win some prizes. And that's what we made Lights Out for. But it was only supposed to be a contest submission. And I did win Best Director, but the movie itself didn't make like the finalists, the top six finalists. So it's like, that was cool. I won Best Director, but that was the end of that. It was what we thought. But then a couple of months after that, it just suddenly went viral. So we got, when that happened, we started getting contacted by all these people like in Hollywood, you know, agents and managers and producers and everything, and started having conversations about making a movie. But while this was going on, that was a little over a year of like back and forth and deciding which manager to go with and talking to the producer and all that. So we didn't know if this was actually real. So that's where we kept making shorts, because it's like, let's not take this for granted. Let's keep making stuff. So most of our shorts were made in that period. And we even started having these plans on to make a feature, just Lotta and I, which would have been difficult, but we had an idea.
It would just be the two of you.
Yeah. The same way we made our shorts, just feature length, basically.
That would have been interesting. I would have taken
it. It would have, but before we got that far, the Hollywood thing turned out to be real, and we got to move here.
So that's the thing I want people to listen to understand, that just because you start getting calls from Hollywood and you get a lot of attention, you have a short and you get some heat, because I've been down that road a bunch of times earlier in my career as well, and you just don't know. Sometimes it pops like it does for you. Sometimes it doesn't, like other directors. Yeah. And you guys were smart. You're like, you know what? This could all be BS.
Yeah.
You didn't feed into the hype, which is so amazing. And how old were you at this point?
Wait, when was this? So I must have been 33 or 34.
All right, so you had been around the block a couple times, you know, so it wasn't like your 20s.
No, that was kind of the thing as well, that we were kind of feeling like something needs to happen soon, because in Sweden, you know, I was trying to get money from the Swedish Film Institute for like horror movies and things like that. And what happened was they were like, well, you're not experienced enough to get the proper funding. And they also have like beginner money, but that's for people under 30. And I was now just over 30. So it's like, well, what am I supposed to do now? I'm too inexperienced for this and I'm too old for that. Like, what are we going to do? Which is why we started just making things with no money on our own.
And then, so you start you spend this year, you're making other short films, and then the thing from Lights Out actually starts turning into a real thing, and they fly you out to LA and they want to make a feature with you off your short, right?
Yeah. So, pretty early on, they wanted us to come out, like our manager and agent wanted us to come out and meet people and everything. But we were like, we don't have any money. We can't fly to the US. That's expensive. So we had to do everything via Skype and email and phone calls and stuff. But then when it started getting closer, the producer of the movie flew us out for a little over a week so we could meet everyone and like start, you know, meet James Wan and who produced the film, and take a bunch of meetings. And then a couple of months after that, it was like, movie's happening. We need you here now, and we're going to pay for the flight and everything.
That was the key point. You'll pay for the flight? Okay, I'll show up.
Otherwise I couldn't do it, you know?
I know. Yeah. I feel you, man. I feel you. Yeah. So you did something that most like a lot of independent filmmakers dream about, which is make a short film, put it on the internet, get it goes viral, Hollywood calls, they want to develop a feature around that short. What was the development process like? Because I'm assuming it was a kind of shock to the system coming from Sweden and doing everything yourself, like a DIY stuff, and then just being thrown into, you know, a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think that experience is pretty unique, going from like no budget, you know, and
no
then
budget Sweden,
right into
the other side of the world, which is another whole conversation. Not like Kansas or another part of America. Like you're completely culture shock on multiple levels.
And yeah, we had no idea that a 2.5 minute short could lead to anything like that. We thought, you know, we had a plan of like, trying to get some money so we could make longer shorts and maybe that would get some attention. You know, we got to skip all of that. But yeah, it was sort of a journey because first of all, I had to figure out who these managers and agents were that contacted me because, you know, I'd never heard their names before. And so I got like an IMDb Pro account, signed up for that so I could see, okay, what other clients do they have? And like, are these guys for real? So yeah, the process was sort of first getting, or, you know, deciding on a manager and an agent. Which it was a very strange position to be in, to have sort of multiple offers, because then once I decided, I had to like contact, you know, like WME and say like, yeah, sorry, I don't want to, I've already picked someone else, you know, which was very strange because if it had been like a month earlier, I would have been begging them to take me on. So that was sort of the first step. And then at first I started talking to a writer who I came into contact with through one of the many managers I was talking to. He was like, hey, I have this client. And he had written this script that I had heard about because, you know, the Blacklist that comes out every year, even, you know, back in Sweden, you can usually find, even there, you can usually find these scripts online. You know, someone always puts them up. So I would download a bunch of scripts to see like, okay, what are good scripts? What do they look like? And he had a horror script that had been on there. So I started talking to this writer. He put me into contact with a producer. He knew Lawrence Gray, who, you know, became the producer on the movie. But then the writer, his ideas were too big for me. Like it was like this worldwide event. And yeah, it was just like, no one's going to give me, a first time director, all this money to do such a big movie. So I told my managers and everyone like, I don't like the idea. And they were like, well, what would you do? And I wrote down sort of a treatment that is very similar to what Lights Out became. And the producer I talked to, he still liked that. And it was just a long back and forth. So then we got Eric Heiser on board through that producer. And then I needed to get a lawyer so we could make a deal and everything. And so I had to lots of, you know, interviews with that. And it was like, well, how do you even pick a lawyer? I don't know. So I went with the guy who had watched my entire YouTube channel, like even the Swedish stuff he had watched, and was like, well, okay, he really seems to be very dedicated. So, okay, now I have a lawyer. Now we have a producer. Now we have a writer. And, you know, it was pretty soon we had like a deal made. And that it was about that point when the producer flew us out so we could meet for real and start talking more and meet with like New Line, because James Wan came on board as a producer. And he was like, a New Line are great for horror, you know, because he had done Conjuring and all this stuff with them. It was just a long process of lots and lots of conversations. And then, you know, once I got here, it was, that was quite a shock too, just because I'd never been on a film set before. Or like, I didn't know how things worked. I knew how to tell a story, but I didn't know how movies were made here beyond what I had seen in, like behind the scenes and commentary tracks on DVDs and things like that.
Yeah, so that's the thing. So you're basically a DIY guy. I mean, you're doing everything yourself. It's like you and your wife, essentially. So you're shooting everything yourself on all these the shorts. And even when you were in talks to do Lights Out, you're still shooting all these shorts by yourself. So coming onto a professional Hollywood set must have been just completely jarring. Like you were saying, you didn't know who did what, other than the only education, because you didn't go to film school, right?
No.
Right. So the only education you had was YouTube or director's commentaries or behind the scenes of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah. No. So when we were interviewing when I got the interview, like the crew members, a lot of that was just asking, so what do you do? What's your job on set? You know, how do these things work? And you know, before we started shooting, we did like a camera test, and that was sort of my first feel of how of a movie set. I mean, it was a smaller scale because it was just a camera test.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But already then it was like, ooh, like when do I say action, or like how do I, that's when I started realizing like, ooh, I really don't know how things work on a movie set. So I had to ask the assistant director, like, yeah, when do I say action? Because it's like, yeah, sound, speed, and these things that were called out first. But yeah, I think they thought that I was more experienced than I was, because they would ask like, okay, so who's the DP you usually work with? Or do you have a storyboard guy? And it's like, no, that's just me doing that myself. So it was just like trying to keep up appearances like I knew what I was doing, because obviously they think I'm more experienced than I am. So it was extremely stressful, to be honest.
I can imagine.
And yeah, trying to navigate that and working with so many professionals, because even, you know, the PAs had more experience than me. They had worked on a bunch of movies. I had never worked on any movie. So yeah, it was extremely stressful.
I could only imagine that the PAs knew more than you. I mean, so you're going through that whole process. Did you have to deal with, because that was like a $5 million budget, right? Like you went from no money to a $5 million budget, which is a substantial shock to the system, and also the pressure and the stress of just having
on
your shoulders.
Well, you'd think so. But what I discovered is that a $5 million movie in the studio system is the absolutely lowest budget. Like they don't even know how to make a movie with less money than that. Because, I mean, things are more expensive with unions and everything and like overhead. And so, and I think on Lights Out as well, crew members were saying like, this feels more like a $1.2 million movie or something. Because I think we had, you know, we had big producers on it and, you know, a lot of above the line money and things. Mm-hmm. I quickly realized that, okay, you can't do anything, because it felt like that. Oh, $5 million, there are no limits to what we can do. but then it was like, yeah, can we have rain in this scene? I was like, no, can't afford that. Oh, okay. And it actually was more limiting because I was told, it was kind of in error, but because I would be like, hey, well, we can do this effect if we just do a split screen, or, you know, we do this thing here. And they were like, well, that's not part of the plan, because that a split screen is a visual effect, you know, that's going to cost money, you know, to get a VFX company or whatever to do these things. And I was like, what, you can do that in the editing software? Or like, but the thing is, you know, when you're editing, I mean, you're just editing QuickTime files, you know, like ProRes or whatever, like proxies, and then everything else is done by the post company or the DIs. It was just very confusing of like, how can I not do these simple things that I can do in my no budget shorts? But what I then found out once we got into the editing process, then the editor told me that, no, the VFX, they don't have a union. So anyone can do VFX. So you can do that yourself if you want to. We can get you the files and you can, but even that was weird, because if I wanted, hey, I need this shot and this shot so I can do it myself, I need the raw files. And then it was like, well, that's a little bit of a cost to get that from the company who's dealing with all the files and where we're going to do the DI and everything. So it was just so many things that kind of felt more limiting than on a no budget short I would make myself, which was weird. But I found out that anyone can do visual effects on a movie. Which helped me in that case.
Now, when you were, and I've had this happen to me on set many times when I'm working, when I was younger, especially when I was coming up, I'd imagine that some people on the set picked up that you were not the most experienced director. They usually smell that out pretty quickly, especially if you're a veteran. Did you have any pushback? Did you have to deal with any kind of politicking on set that you have to deal
Definitely.
With?
These were guys who had worked on huge movies, you know, like X-Men and, like, you know, these things. And I think some of them were just doing it kind of like a favor to James Wan, or, you know, wanted to be in his circle. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, one problem was, you know, when we're doing the effect of the ghost being there and not being there, I mean, it's simple. Like, you put the camera down and then you shoot it with a person and then without a person. You do a clean plate. And what happened was, like, I got into this argument with the camera guy because, like, we shot the ghost there. And then it's like, okay, now let's do the clean plate. And he was like, we already got it. I was like, what? No, we don't have it from this angle. No, but we got it from the other angle. That's fine, you know. And it was like, what are you talking about? Like, I can't cut between the two things. I mean, if it's off even a centimeter,
yeah,
it's not going to work. I mean, what I've then learned on doing Shazam, like, on a movie like that, the clean plates don't have to match that much, you know, because they'll, you know, you can just do a somewhat similar move, or you're like, you can move the camera around and whatever, and they'll take the clean plate and, like, reproject it and track it and create a new shot that matches perfectly from that. So, I mean, the camera operator on Lights Out, I mean, he came from movies like that. So to him, it's like, well, we already shot that area without a person when we were over here, so they can just use that. But that turned into an argument where I had to, like, I think that was the first time I had to, like, raise my voice on that film set, where it's like, no, just put the camera here. Okay. Press record. Okay. Now we take in the actor, we do the thing, keep rolling. Now she steps out, and, like, I had to really do it, like, step by step. This is how we do it. So, and there were a lot of things like that. And, I've talked about, you know, with the DP as well, like, he was, kind of, you know, he was worried about going too dark. And I was like, well, it needs to be really dark. That's what the whole movie is about. Yeah.
It's called Lights Out.
But he was worried that, well, you know, if the studio thinks it's too dark, they're not going to hire me again. And,
right. Politics. You know,
yeah. There were a lot of those things that were extremely frustrating. And, you know, I'm not a very confrontational guy, so it sort of builds up until I just can't deal with it anymore. And either I get depressed or I will have to raise my voice and get it done, you know.
And that's the reality of things. These are the kind of stories I love to talk about, because these are the things that are generally not in the press kit, generally not in the press tour of films. And filmmakers, when they watch a story like yours, they're like, oh, my God, look what, you know, what David Sandberg did. He did Lights Out. And you become one of those kind of like El Mariachi stories,
right, yeah.
You know, or Kevin Smith stories, like, you know, those kind of mythical stories, like, oh my God, that's the thing. But there's stuff that happens behind the scenes that they have to understand, that this is, there's the lottery ticket, which is what
yeah.
you know, you got, but there's a lot of people who didn't win the lottery, or there's a lot of stuff in between that going through yeah. that process that they don't talk about. So that's why I love going a little bit deeper into these things, so people really have an understanding about what the realities of working in Hollywood.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing I reflect on now afterwards is like how bad things could have gotten, because when we got here, you know, they paid for the flight and they paid for, you know, a hotel for a couple of weeks, and then we had to find a place and everything. But the thing was that I didn't start getting paid until the movie was officially greenlit, which was weird, because we had like a production office with all these people there working, and I was like, well, how can the movie not be greenlit? Like,
we're spending money.
We're spending money. Everyone's here. It's like, why am I not getting paid? So, you know, we had to, first of all, you know, we borrowed everything we could from our families back home, like, so we could survive. And then that money ran out. And so then we borrowed money from the producer. We borrowed money from my manager. And it was like, it was this feeling of like, if this falls apart now, and movies can fall apart at any moment, like you can start shooting a movie and it falls apart and you everyone has to go home. If that had happened, we would have been in so much shit, because we wouldn't have been able to pay back people. Because that was another shock, coming here and finding out like what rent is in LA.
It's very affordable to live in LA. Very. Extremely yeah. affordable.
I mean, we lived in Gothenburg, which is not the cheapest city in Sweden. And, you know, our apartment there we thought was pretty expensive for us. And we came here and we lived in half a garage in Burbank, and the rent was 2.5 times our big apartment in Sweden. And it's just like, holy shit. And that's another thing. Everything happened so quick that we didn't have time to like sublet our apartment or anything. So we just sort of locked the door and got on a plane. And so that money was going as well. So it's like, if this doesn't happen now, we're going to be in so much shit, you know. And I'm sure there are, for every story like ours, I'm sure there's like 100 or 1,000 stories of people where it did go to shit and they were like,
it mostly
broke and yeah. So, I mean, we know how extremely lucky we were that it worked out.
I moved out here 12 years ago and I literally all I had was a Final Cut system and my wife. We got an apartment in North Hollywood. We had, I think, $10,000 or $12,000 saved up. And I had no job. I knew two people in LA. My wife knew nobody. And we just like, we'll figure it out. And we're like, we have at least 6 months to a year that we can survive. But I know a lot of personal friends of mine who made the trip out here and try to make a go of it. And they go because it's too hard. Your story is definitely the unique story in the bunch. But you're right. You were actually in a place where you were like you were working with big producers and you were still not getting paid. And that's nothing against them. It's just the way the system is set up. And you're coming in just looking around going, what do you mean? How can I not be being paid? We have an office. Like, this is not the way business is run in general.
Yeah. Now, I remember one of the guys involved with them, one of the producers, was talking about having like a chef working for like a private chef or whatever, who was getting like $1,000 a week. And I was like, holy fucking shit. Like, I'd kill to have $1,000 a week to get paid that. You know, it's like we felt so, you know, like such outsiders. And, you know, pretty early on after we got here was when, you know, James Wan, he had Furious 7 had just made like $1 billion.
Sure.
So, and we were invited to like, we were at the same agency. So we were invited to this like party in honor of James Wan to celebrate his achievement. And so Lotta and we had no money. So we were like, okay, what kind of clothes do we have that we can look kind of fancy in, you know, and we're sweet. So we're always like, early, we're on time, you know. So we show up to this mansion in Beverly Hills and they had like valets, and I was like, holy, did they valets for a private house? It's like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And we go in there, and since we're so early, there's like pretty much no one else there. It's just the two of us in this giant mansion. And then these people start coming in, and we were just like, we felt like such imposters, you know, like we had just snuck into this party. So we were just like standing in a corner. And, you know, we had our own secret language, Swedish. Yeah. So we were like trying to look like we were just having a casual conversation. But all we were saying was just like, holy shit, like, what are we doing here? This is just weird. And then like these celebrities would show up, like Vin Diesel and Adrian Brody. And like, holy, yeah, it was just surreal. And yeah, we were just two broke Swedes who felt like we had just gotten into a Hollywood party.
Yeah, you're waiting for any time, any moment security would come in, like, you two, come here. You're not supposed to be here. Just time
yeah. yeah.
That's insane. All right, so you had that experience, and obviously Lights Out came out. It was a very big hit for the studio. It did very well, especially off of the budget that you made. So then they offer you your second feature, Annabelle Creation.
Yeah, they actually did that before the movie even came out because they, you know, we had test screenings and stuff and it tested really well. So everyone was really happy about it. And everyone, this is going to be a hit. And I was like, well, how can you know? Like, you can't be sure, it could be a total bomb. But everyone's really sure that it was going to be a hit. So they offered me Annabelle, a sequel to Annabelle. So, yeah, I started working on that before Lights Out was even out. So that came out during the middle of shooting Annabelle, which was also very surreal in that we had to, like, wrap early that day so I could go to the premiere of Lights Out at the, you know, Chinese theater, mm-hmm. which is so Hollywood. Like, yeah, we have to go wrap early so I can go to the premiere of my other movie. But I think it was also good because then I didn't have time to freak out. Like, oh, how is it going to perform and mm-hmm. all of that? Because I was already on my second movie. And that was also a thing where it's like I needed to find a second movie quickly because on the first one, you know, I got paid scale for that movie because it was my first one. And, you know, scale on a $5 million movie is still more money than I'd ever made before. But because we like had to pay everyone back and like you take care of everything, that movie, that money was starting to run out. And now I remember like this person at the studio was surprised, like, what, you already burned through your Lights Out money? It's like, yeah, I had to pay back a lot of people. So that was, you know, I had to find something, the next thing quickly. And I was very happy that they offered me to direct Annabelle.
So then what was the difference in experience from, you know, doing Lights Out to Annabelle?
I mean, it was night and day. I mean, I still, to this day, Annabelle Creation has been the best experience so far. Because then I knew how movies worked, mm-hmm. like how a film set worked. And I knew all the steps, you know, because there was just so much learning. I mean, even, you know, when we were doing the sound mixing on Lights Out, I came in there and they were like doing all these things. And I'm like, okay, so when do I say what I want or like what's happening here? And like, it was, you know, so on Annabelle Creation, I finally felt that, okay, now I know the whole process. I know how a film set works. And now we had more days, we had more money. And it was just pleasant experience. It was just, yeah, enough money, enough days, and less pressure as well, because it wasn't my first movie and this feeling of, I better get this right, or this is my one shot at Hollywood, because now I felt like, yeah, even if I fuck this up, I will have made two movies in Hollywood, and, you know, I might still get a third chance if Lights Out does well and everything.
Yeah, and I'm imagining that it was a good feeling that while you're in production on Annabelle, that you're, you know, you see the returns and the reviews on Lights Out come out, and I'm sure that boosted your confidence a bit. I mean, we all go through imposter syndrome. I'm assuming you probably were infected with imposter syndrome all the time.
No, and the thing was that I hated Lights Out until we had test screenings of it, because just watching it, I mean, first of all, I mean, the first times you watch it, it's temp audio, temp music, and like temp effects, and like the colors aren't right, and it just feels really lame. So I was really depressed seeing like the first cut of it, and thinking like, maybe we can cut a cool trailer out of it because there's some cool shots in there, but the movie just sucks. So we, you know, just started cutting out as much as possible, just like take out this, take out that scene, and trim this, and just to get it down to like the bare bones story. Like, I just wanted as little of the movie in the movie as possible. So it's a very tight movie at 80 minutes. But but I still sort of felt that this is a piece of shit until we started screening it to people, and I could sit there in the audience and hear and see their reactions. They were laughing, they were getting scared. And that was the moment where it's like, okay, maybe it isn't so bad. Maybe this is an okay movie after all. So, yeah, it wasn't until then that I started feeling a little bit better about it.
And then Annabelle comes out, and it's also another hit. So you have now hit – you've had two hits back to back.
Yeah.
And so you didn't even have time to worry about your sophomore curse.
No.
You know, the jinx. There's no – you were in the middle.
And it was the same thing with Shazam, that I got that job before Annabelle Creation was even out.
Really?
So yeah, my agents and I mean, everyone was telling me like, don't get used to this. Like, things don't usually go this quickly and this well. Like, it's not normal.
Right. And but then you got Shazam, which is that's a step up. A budget. Yeah. That's a step up in everything. And yeah. Shazam, you know, you're in the DC universe now, which, you know, the DC universe has had a couple stumbles along the way on their side, and they have some, you know, obviously Batman and Superman and those kind of things, but it was rough. And then you got something like Shazam, which was coming out completely different. And it's not a dark and broody movie. It is a fun, let's have some fun kind of movie. It's what I love about Shazam so much. It was just so much fun. And it's also, I mean, the story is great with the little kid that turns into, but who doesn't want that story? So, you know, what was it like dealing with not only the pressure of a big studio movie, and it's a big superhero movie, but also translating a beloved IP and character onto the screen. That's never really been on the screen like that before. I don't think never been at that level.
No, they did serials in the 40s and a TV show in the 70s. But no movies.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
It was interesting in that he's not as known as, you know, Superman or Batman or Spider-Man or anything like that. And he hasn't had movies before, which I think helped a lot because I can't imagine like taking on like Superman, a Superman movie or something, because there are so many expectations and there are so many like versions of, you know, some people will, Superman has to be this way for them. Other people are like, Superman has to be this. Shazam is like, I mean, he's been around for as long as Superman, but he's never been quite as big, or at least not recently. And there have been a lot of different variations of him in the comic book world as well. So it didn't feel like, oh, it has to be this one thing. And so it was a bit, that pressure wasn't as big, I don't think. And also the fact that it was something so different from what I'd done before felt like, if I fuck this up, I don't want to fuck this up, but if I do, it's something that's completely different, because then I can go back to horror. It was like, yeah, superheroes, that's not for me, obviously, but horror, I can still get more chances there. But yeah, overall, making the movie was like making my first movie again, just because there was so much to learn. It was so big, and it was, you know, things that are sort of out of your control. Like, for example, with visual effects on Lights Out and Annabelle Creation, I did some of the visual effects shots myself. And even the ones I didn't, I would shoot in such a way that I would know exactly how to put it together myself if I would have to. Mm-hmm. While on a movie like Shazam, it's just such crazy stuff going on. That it's like, I don't actually know how we do this. So you have to like listen to the visual effects guys and like, okay, so what do you need? You need these elements to put this together. And I've always had issues working with like storyboard people, because like I tried it on Lights Out, but then it was like, you know, they would go off and draw things and then they'd come back with all these shots, and it's like, but I want to design the shots. I mean, if they're doing that, then they're kind of making the movie, you know? Right. So I had real problems with that. So on Annabelle Creation, there was just a couple of sequences where we need the storyboard. So for some of that, I would draw really simple things myself because I didn't have time to do them properly all by myself. So I would draw, you know, little thumbnails. And it's like, yeah, just do this, but make them look better. And then on Shazam, I finally got into this thing of like, I don't have to do, I mean, I can do a lot of revisions with them, but I also don't have to do exactly what they draw. It's just sort of a starting point, and then we can work it from that, you know. It was more of getting the action right, so we can take that to previs and so on. But yeah, I've always had that feeling of, I don't want to give up all this work, especially not like figuring out the shots, because that's sort of what filmmaking is to me.
Right. Now, so working on a film of this magnitude and this kind of scale, and I think you're right, because Shazam's not Superman, Batman, or Spider-Man, or something that's so well known, there wasn't as much a pressure or attention. Like, I remember when I saw the trailer, I'm like, oh, that's going to be interesting. But it wasn't like, but when the next Batman comes out, everyone starts thinking of Nolan. Or when Superman came out, like, everyone starts thinking of Donner, or, you know, or X-Men.
Much comparison and like things to live up to, and you know.
So in 40 years, when they make a reboot of Shazam, they're going to be like, but David Shazam. Right. You've got to live up to the David Shazam version of Shazam. So the pressure's not as much, but working inside the studio system with Lights Out and Annabelle, that's a certain level. But when you're dealing within the studio system with so much money at risk here, what kind of pressures are you dealing with creatively? Because you're being hired as a director to tell the story, to direct the film. But there is so many other kind of pressures, which is like, I mean, I don't even know what the budget was. If it was,
$100 million.
Yeah, it's like $100 million. Yeah. So when you've got $100 million on the line, people are a little bit more on hand. And there's
you can feel some of the concerns more, like you know, I mean, they're in any movie, they're gonna care about casting, and but maybe it's a little bit more, and then you know, a lot of they'll look more at different choices. It's and just making sure that is this the right way to go. But I think they're quite open at Warner Brothers, because I've heard stories from other people working with on certain movies at certain other studios, not just superhero movies, but the movies of that size, where it's like, I've heard horror stories where a director comes in and they already have like previs for the action scenes. And it's like, you know, I wouldn't, that sounds awful. Like, so you just do the,
why am I here?
The dialogue scenes or like, and you know, I didn't have, that was the good thing about Shazam, that I got to do all those things and I got to cast it. And, you know, because there wasn't already a Shazam cast for the universe or whatever. So it felt quite free in that way. But yeah, of course people care a lot when it's that much money at stake, you know?
Right. And launching a new IP based off of a new filmmaking IP is based on an old IP. One thing I have noticed too in your films is that I think I saw a video. I think you were saying it on one of your amazing YouTube videos about characters, and like the more characters you have, the more complicated things get. And man, yeah. Shazam has a lot of characters to deal with. So what tips can you give in regards to other than not having so many characters? So you had an obscene amount of characters, ton of visual effects.
Yeah.
You know, how
do I mean, Shazam 2 is even worse, because now all the kids, I mean, they all have superpowers. So, you know, all the action scenes are with most of them, you know, and it's quite an ordeal. it's just like a lot of figuring out, you know, like for Shazam, I would do like this overhead view of the carnival, and because it was even more complicated at one point. And I had all these like icons that I animated to just keep track of, okay, this person is here and then they move here and then this happens. It's just so much to keep track of, which, you know, when you see a finished movie, it doesn't seem that complicated. You just go, yeah, of course they cut to this and then this guy is here and then they fly there.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it seems obvious, but to get there is just so much work and worry of like, oh, how is this going to fit together? And yeah.
It's not as easy as it looks. I mean, you make it look easy, so that's that's why you get hired.
Right. No, but I don't have a good solution for it other than don't do stuff where you have six superheroes all the time and then seven sins and it's so much.
you look stressed out just talking about it.
Well, yeah. No, but it was interesting because we tried to fit in a little horror movie between Shazam 1 and Shazam 2. It didn't work out for a bunch of reasons, and I mean, COVID
stopped
everything as well. So I was very sad about that because I really wanted to have that sort of palate cleanse. I mean, it's a great problem to have. It's like, oh no, I get to do a second superhero movie in a row. You know?
Oh darn.
Yeah. No, but it would have. I really look forward to, you know, next movie. It's definitely going to be smaller. Like, we wanted to do this little horror movie, but a lot of it is just a guy in a cabin. You know, it's like, oh, would have been so easy to shoot. And I mean, when you look at like dramas and things, it's like, imagine how easy it is to shoot that, because once you cut it, you almost have your movie. It's not like months of visual effects reviews and over and over again and just all this complicated stuff. It's just like, yeah, it's people talking and a little drama and then it's over, you know?
Yeah, and then maybe you clean out a little thing here. You clean out a license plate there in visual effects, something simple.
Yeah.
But nothing is crazy. So at what point in the process did you – because I'm assuming that as you're making Shazam, when did you feel that you had something that was fun? Or did you have the same feeling as you did Lights Out? This is horrible. My career is over. Oh, my God.
It felt – some of it felt pretty good. Like I would watch certain things back on the dailies. You know, you get an iPad where you can access all the dailies. So there were things there where I would like rewatch at the day's end. It's like, yeah, this is pretty cool. I think this is pretty good. And when we shot the first sort of Shazam scene, we shot was in the convenience store when he gets shot for the first time. It's like, hey, I'm bulletproof. It was just when we shot that scene, it felt like this is fun. Like this is, I think this could be something. And then there were, of course, other scenes where it's like, oh shit, this is terrible. We need to fix this somehow or cut it out. But yeah, it felt like there were good things in there, you know.
Did you do any reshoots? Did you have to go back to doing
reshoots? Yes, we did. I mean, New Line that I've done all my music, that they always do reshoots. So yeah, because it kind of gets a bad rap of like, oh, the movie must be in trouble because they're doing reshoots. But they always do that. They count on it, which is, it's interesting because on my first movie, on Lights Out, I was told by one of the editors that here's what's going to happen. You know, you're going to test the movie. If it tests well, they're going to come to you and say, so what do you want to add or reshoot? If it tests poorly, they're going to come to you and say, here's what we're going to reshoot or what we're going to add. And luckily, the movies have tested well. And Shazam was very interesting because I think we did a lot of reshoots and things, which it kind of felt like, it almost feels like this movie is in trouble or something because we're reshooting so much. But I think it was more of a thing of, well, we only spent $100 million on this or close to that. I'm sure we had some savings. So it was like, yeah, why not just get a little extra money and see if we can, make it even better in certain places.
Spice it up.
Yeah. And I mean, some of that, it was interesting because like in the main shoot, in the script, there was that scene where he's on the rocky steps in Philadelphia by the art museum. You know, he's doing the lightning with my hands. Mm-hmm. That was always in the script. But then during the main shoot, it's like, well, we don't have the money to actually go to Philadelphia. So it's like, okay, we'll shoot it here on this street in Toronto. And then when I showed the movie to the studio, they were like, oh, yeah, that scene really needed to be in Philadelphia. So go to Philadelphia, shoot that scene, you know. And there were a lot of those things where it's like, yeah, maybe we can just make it a little better. Like the opening of the movie originally had young Savannah in his house during dinner and he takes an elevator and winds up in the Rock of Eternity. And they were like, maybe we can do more action or maybe we can have something like with a car crash or something. And to me, it was like, hey, if you want to pay for a car crash, I'd love to shoot that, you know? And because the thing is, if it turns out better than what we have, great. If it turns out worse, then we still have the old thing, you know? Sure. So I was open to anything. Like, yeah, let's do this. Let's shoot that scene and do this, you know, and see what happens. As long as you pay for it, I'm willing to do it. And some things I asked for in particular, like originally when they first get to the group home, I did all that in one continuous Steadicam shot. And it just didn't work. It just felt it didn't get there. And then there's no editing you can do when you do that. So I was like, I told the studio, it's like, I really want to reshoot that. But I know that's a big ask because that means rebuilding that whole set. And the studio is just like, it's a big movie. So we actually rebuilt the whole set and I got to reshoot that scene. So yeah, they were happy with what they saw and felt like it was okay to spend more money because it was going to be good.
Right. Now, you also a post-production guy. You do a lot of stuff yourself. So how much are you involved in the post-production process in your films from Lights Out all the way to Shazam? Because like you were saying earlier, you're not doing all the visual effects, but do you even still do titles or stuff like that?
Yeah, yourself? I mean, certainly for Shazam, I never did any final thing. I think some of the overlays for the news is mine, the newscast. But otherwise, I did tons of temp effects. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you do test screenings, I mean, we do that quite early on. And you want it to look all right. You don't want all these blue screen and weird things in there. So I would do a lot of temp effects myself just to try to get it as closely as possible, which is pretty fun because then when you do temp effects, it only needs to be good enough for one quick viewing. You know, no one's going to rewind and look at it again. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot more fun than when you do final visual effects, because there's so much work for those little things just to make it right, you know. So lots of temp effects, and I'm quite involved in during the post process, because I think that's probably one of the most fun aspects of movies.
Yeah, it's when it's like, I forgot who said it, but you make three movies: you make the movie, you write your movie, you produce, and the movie you edit.
Absolutely, and I love that kind of problem solving as well, where like, okay, if we cut this scene out, now this, you know, now that we don't have B, how do we go from A to C? And you start looking at, okay, what kind of footage do we have and what can I create? Because that's stuff I did for Lights Out as well. It's like, I need this shot of just a push in on this empty room, but we don't have that. But I have a similar thing here where I can take textures and reproject them in Blender in 3D and create that shot, you know? I love that stuff of like just figuring out stuff at home, or in Animal Creation, there's an insert shot of blood dripping on the floor. And that was one where I shot with my little Blackmagic pocket camera in my apartment, you know, with some food coloring, and just put that in the movie. And yeah, you know, just that puzzling together and just finding nifty solutions is really fun.
So you actually shot something with a pocket camera and just inserted it and no one cared. It was like perfect.
Yeah, and that shot in Animal Creation. There's a shot in a bedroom where you see all these photographs of Janice growing up. I shot that on my Ursa Mini 4.6K, and put the pictures in there with Blender and everything. And yeah, it works great.
And that's again another myth that you're debunking. That once you get to a certain level, you like you don't do things like that. Of course you do.
No, but yeah. And I mean, even when we were, I remember when we were, I think we were mixing Lights Out, Michael Bay was mixing a movie on the soundstage next to us. And they were telling me that he had been out in the parking lot shooting something on his iPhone for the movie, because he was already so far down the post-production that he was in the sound mix. But he was like, oh, we need a shot of this thing. And he shot it on his iPhone out in the parking lot, and they put it in the movie and made it at work. So, yeah, it certainly happens on everything.
Now, what is the most stressful part of making a movie for you?
Well, I mean, the shooting in general, just sort of keeping up with everything, because it's such a marathon and you get so tired. And like, there were days on Shazam where I was like sick and I was just, yeah, not doing well at all. But you just have to do it. And Shazam was also weird in that was my first time really working a lot with a second unit. Mm-hmm. And just like with the storyboards, it's like, I don't want someone else making the movie, you know? So we scheduled it so that we shot main unit during the day, and then second unit was shooting during the night. So I could, once we wrapped the day, I would go to second unit and hang out there and make sure that they shot things the way I wanted to. So I didn't get a lot of sleep for a few weeks there, which was all, you know, not healthy and something I need to work on. But it's just hard, especially when you start sort of when you're far along a shoot where you start feeling like you're behind and you're like, I haven't even had time to think of this thing we're going to shoot next. It's like, oh shit. Like when it feels like things are just coming at you at a quicker pace than you can keep up with. Mm-hmm. That's very stressful, and you need to sort of just take any moment you can and just sit down and think about how you're going to do all these things.
Now, do you suffer from the same thing as I think I do and many directors do, is when you're done on the last day of production, isn't that kind of depression starts setting in, like you've built that family? If it's been a good experience, obviously. If it's been a bad experience, not so much. But do you get that kind of feeling too, like,
Not that soon. I mean, when you wrap the movie, it's like, oh, it's over. Like, I'll get to sleep for a few days, you know. But certainly, yeah, once you're finished with a project, you get that feeling of like, oh, well, what now? And, you know, It feels kind of empty. And then that happens with even with short films and stuff as well. Like you have a purpose and you know what you're doing, and then it's done. It's like, that was it. Okay, what now? You know?
Always looking for that next high, if you will.
Yeah. It's just that, yeah, in the moment you have a purpose and you know what your future is going to be like.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And then afterwards it's like, okay, well, what's my future now? And what's my goal now? And what's going to happen? You know?
Now, I have to ask you about your little – I need to know the backstory about your little-known four-hour feature film that got released called I Flip You Off for 4 Hours, which is an official film – it's officially on your IMDb as a feature film. So when I saw that, I was like, wait, what is that? I didn't hear about this. And I started looking at it, and it is available on YouTube. Can you please tell us the backstory of that film?
Yeah. No, what happened was I was talking in one of my YouTube videos about the fact that, you know, being a YouTuber isn't my job.
Right.
So I don't really have to care about views and all of that stuff that YouTubers have to worry about. Like, oh, how's my channel doing and everything. And as an example, I was like, you know, I can do whatever I want. And as an example, I had a screenshot of a movie called I Flip You Off for 4 Hours with just a picture of me doing that. So that was just a joke in that video. But then for some reason, some months later, I was like, well, maybe I'll actually do that just for the hell of it, just as a joke. So I did that. And it's a cheat, of course. I did it for less than a minute and just added it together so it looks like it's 4 hours. But I put that up and people really ran with it. And they put it up on Letterboxd. And people started giving it this all fantastic reviews. So it's like for a moment there, it was like among the top rated movies on Letterboxd, like next to like Parasite, you know, the Oscar winner and all these. But then eventually Letterboxd took it off because it's like it's not a real movie. But I love seeing
they?
That.
How dare yeah. they? How dare yeah. they?
Everyone just ran with it. I love when the internet does dumb stuff like that, with not like now with the Bernie Sanders.
Oh my God.
Sitting in his chair. I've seen that in every situation now. Like people have drawn artwork and paintings.
I saw dolls. They're making dolls of it now.
Yeah, I saw like a crocheted doll and like, yeah, it's everywhere.
But you heard what internet Bernie did now. Fun. But you know what Bernie did now, right? He actually grabbed it, put it on a t-shirt, and now he's selling it for charity.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
That's amazing.
So David, let me ask you a question. So if you could do one thing and say one thing to your younger self before you started directing at first, like the one thing that you wish you would have known before you started going down this directing journey, what would that be?
I don't know. I mean, maybe to ask for a little bit more or not be too afraid with some things. But I mean, that was the big thing with Lights Out, where we didn't want to ask for too much because it was like, oh, this is our shot. Like, for example, right. Lotta, you know, she really should have been a producer on the first movie. I mean, we're sort of correcting these things now. We started mm-hmm. our own production company and whatnot. But it was like, oh, let's not ask for too much. And it's the same thing where I've always seen myself as a writer and director. Mm-hmm. But like, I couldn't ask for like, oh, yeah, I want to write the movie as well, because, you know, first time director, first time writer as well, then they're going to say no.
Right.
So there have been moments where it's like, I probably could have pushed for a little bit more, but at the same time, it's worked out great. You know, I love what Eric Heiser did with the script. I mean, he's a great writer, and I've gotten to work with writers and see how that is and get, you know, feedback and be able to bounce ideas off of each other. So, but yeah, maybe I think that's been a bit of a problem sometimes of me not, you know, being a little too afraid of conflict or like taking too much space and instead backing off.
Yeah, just ask for a little bit more. I feel that a lot of artists are like that. I was like that as well. You know, I would do jobs God, for anything. It's like, yeah. You're going to pay me to do this? Oh, sure. Whatever you want to give me.
Yeah. That's been a constant problem of, you know, back in Sweden. Now it's great having like agents and managers dealing with that. So they can be the bad guys. You know, that's been awesome.
Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Well, I mean, what I always say, because it was my path, it was to just keep creating things. Because mm-hmm. the more you create, I mean, for everything you do, you're going to learn. Even if it turns out to be shit, then you learn what not to do. And you're going to get better and better for every short or every little creative thing you do. And it just, you know, it's like buying more lottery tickets. Because, you know, one of those things you do might really resonate with people. We had no idea that Lights Out was going to become the thing it did. And also, you know, whenever I do something, I always think it's shit halfway through, whatever it is, if it's a short or it's a feature halfway through, I think it's shit and I want to give up. But that's, you have to actually finish the things you start, even if it feels like it's shit, because you don't know how you'll feel about it later on. Because whenever, you know, you do the next thing, you think like, well, why do I suck now? The previous thing I did was good. But when you were making the previous thing, you hated that too. So you just never know.
I think that's basically just being an artist.
Yeah. Many,
it is the cross we have to bear. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, if it's something, I'm still just trying to figure out the best way to do certain things. Like, best, is it, you know, storyboards or, you know, I've been experimenting with so many different things, everything from shooting action figures to just walking around a location and shooting things, you know, trying to find shots even without people and like cutting together that stuff. And I'm still working out what is the best, quickest way to get my thoughts and ideas across to other people. And it's hard, but yeah, at the moment I'm using a Blender a lot to do like little animatics and animated things and boards. And that's been working pretty well.
What is the biggest fear you had to overcome to make your first film?
I think it's, has a lot to do with knowing that being confident in myself in many ways. Because like on that first movie, there were arguments where I felt like, well, these guys have done it for so long, so of course they have to know better than me. They have to be right. I have to be wrong because I'm new at this. But I wasn't always wrong. There were things where, like, no, I do know this. So experience does not always make you right. So you could, yeah, even experienced people can be wrong. And I think that's something that can be good to know sometimes.
And what are three of your favorite films of all time?
Aliens is up there. Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, it sort of changes a lot, sort of. But yeah, those two and like The Thing, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing. But yeah, I think Aliens is probably the movie I've seen the most.
That was
over and over.
But it's a masterpiece. I mean, it's an absolute masterpiece. I mean, Cameron. I mean, Jesus, man. Did you ever see you've seen The Abyss, obviously?
Oh yeah, both versions.
And obviously James's version is much much better, I think. The tidal wave.
It is a little long, but it's
But the tidal wave makes it does work. Did you see the behind the scenes of that? The whole movie, the documentary of how they made that movie, James Cameron.
Oh yeah, and all the problems and everything. And I love the like 3 hours documentary about Aliens.
So in depth. It's absolutely insane. But David, I want to thank you for not only being on the show, but I want to make sure everybody knows about your YouTube channel, because you're one of the few directors out there who still are trying to give back, even after they are, you know, after they hit a certain level of success in the business. A lot of times they just, oh, whatever, Screw the little filmmaker. I don't care. I'm not that guy anymore. You're still doing it. I mean, up until recently, like, you know, a few weeks ago, I think you posted a new video. You do it often, man. So thank you so much for doing that. It really means a lot to me and to also a lot of filmmakers out there are learning. And I've watched your stuff, your videos, and I've learned stuff. I'm like, that, yes. Like, I didn't know about the reverse. I didn't, I kind of knew about the reverse thing with the neck. In Alien with the edits, like doing that within the edits and stuff like that, like they just reversed it. Cause I know Coppola and it's just the oldest Hollywood trick in the book is to shoot something in reverse. But Cameron did it so beautifully in that scene that you just don't even realize it.
It's the stuff I love to see. That's why what I can, you know, but I do understand why directors don't do it because you kind of reveal things where, you know, you can get things in a movie that seem like they were intentional or brilliant, and maybe it was just an accident or like something that just, oh, well, we were going to do this and then that fell apart. So we just slapped something together and it happened to work. You know, like you kind of reveal your
the magic
or like,
like you pull the curtain back a little bit. And sometimes directors want to keep that magic.
Yeah, because then people can think that, oh, he's a genius doing all these things. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not a genius. I'm very open with that.
Well, very humble of you, sir, to not call yourself a genius. But this, seriously, man, thank you so much for being on the show and continue doing what you do. And I cannot wait to see Shazam 2. Is Black Adam going to be in Shazam 2?
No, not in, no.
No, he's not.
They're separate for now. But
maybe
in the third movie or something.
Yeah, so they're building it up. They're building it up.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, listen, man, continued success, brother. I really appreciate what you do, man. So thanks again.
Thank you, man.
I want to thank David so much for being on the show, dropping those knowledge bombs as well as inspiration for all of the tribe to continue going no matter what, because all you have is the process. Dedicate yourself to the process and things will happen. I can't guarantee it's going to be the exact path that David took, but something will happen. Just keep at the process. Keep making content. Keep making films. Keep telling stories. And I promise you, something good will come out of it. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/165. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.